within the next few weeks, so let me get started. I won't worry about the contents. So I'm actually going to start probably giving a little bit more motivation than what Andre did, because this is the way I wrote my talk. And it starts actually at this meeting last year when Andre raised several criticisms of these models that have appeared also this week in several talks, but have been in being discussed in this evolution of ideas of how entanglement is affected by acceleration over the last 8 or so years. So what the latest sort of generation of models decides to do is set up a problem where you have a two-mode Fock state prepared between two observers, Alice and Bob, where Alice prepares her mode in some maybe Minkowski plane wave mode, whereas Bob decides to do this in an Unruh mode, and perhaps you assume that they're in different parts of the Hilbert space so that we can think of Alice and Bob's modes as not mixing, so maybe they have different polarizations or they're different parity or something like that. And then the questions have been asked about how this particular state is changed and seen by an accelerated observer, Bob, who only has access to the same part as Bob of that Hilbert space, and how this Unruh mode is transformed, essentially. So the Unruh mode is, you don't need to know much about what an Unruh mode is for this talk, but everything I'll explain is essentially that waveform up there. And it's just a wave function in space. And to define one, you don't need to know anything about acceleration. You don't need to suggest a setup with acceleration. It's just a mode in space-time. But it has a nice property in that you can expand it in terms of a left region and a right region in Minkowski space. And the left and the right regions are essentially the same thing, except there's a branch cut. How does this work? There's a branch cut which picks up this extra phase here. It's kind of like the extra day I picked up coming here from Japan when I crossed the international dateline. And these are related to these Rindler modes, which an accelerated observer who is accelerating at acceleration of A would define. This one here is related to the region 1 Rindler mode, and this one here is related to the region 2. And after normalization, we can make an identification between these two modes. What one needs to do, though, is do this in a different way for every accelerated observer. So it's each accelerated observer, for his given acceleration, needs to define a correspondence between this Unruh mode with a momentum given by his acceleration times by this parameter omega, which appears in the Unruh mode. And each accelerated observer can do this. Of course, they will use different frequencies in this decomposition. But the coefficients of the decomposition will be the same, and they will only depend on the initial parameter that we use to describe our Unruh mode. Okay. So each accelerated observer actually sees the same result for his entanglement. You can go through the calculation, or a simpler thing you can see. It's just that there's no real difference between which mode you're looking at in this calculation, or that the only parameter that appears in this dimensionless parameter that appears in this construction so far is this parameter omega. And so your entanglement is a dimensionless number, and so it has to depend on a dimensionless parameter, and the only thing you have is omega so far. So actually, every accelerated observer sees the same degradation. There is, of course, degradation, because there are parts of the mode that don't get observed. But there's no change for different accelerated observers. So what was happening in the last 8 years? So what were people doing? They were actually changing this parameter omega, which is equivalent to changing your initial state. So they were asking a different question. They weren't asking what happens to entanglement as an observer accelerates. They were asking, how is this entanglement degradation that happens in the Rindler frame and between the Rindler frame and the Minkowski frame, how does that change for different initial states that are parameterized by this parameter, omega? It's an interesting question. But there's unfortunately nothing physically relevant about these Unruh modes. If you plot them, they look like, it's hard to draw them actually, because this, like Andre explained, a logarithmically squashed version of a sinusoid. So they oscillate very rapidly here, and then they go off to infinity. This is not going to be easy to prepare in a lab, so it's not clear why this is a good thing to you would want to study. And it's not really the problem that we want to ask. We want to ask, how is entanglement degraded by acceleration? So let's try again. So we start with a localized mode, with something that we can construct, of some length L. And we ask the question, we have to think about what we want to,
how we want to set up the problem.
So we could ask the question about different accelerated observers. But if they're offset by some different position relative to the mode, then of course they're going to see a different thing, because one is going to be in a position where the mode is at, say, t equals zero, and he's going to see a lot of the mode if he makes some projected measurement on the mode. But if another observer is far away from that mode, then he'll only see the tail, and he won't be able to reconstruct much of what was there.
So that's not the question we want to ask. What we do want to ask is,
how do different accelerated observers, which pass through the same point at t equals zero, observe that mode? So, at x1,
how do different accelerated observers with different curvatures
in their world line see that mode? And so this is what we want to do. Now, what does that mean if we try and push these world lines out and make them fit into the Rindlov world line so we can start doing some calculations?
We see that
the smaller accelerated world lines get pushed further, and the larger accelerations get pushed closer to the horizon. And to be consistent with what I said before, what we need to do is actually translate this mode in this Rindlov coordinate system. So for low accelerations, the mode will be translated to further away from this horizon, and for large accelerations, it will be closer. Okay.
So this is now a new family of modes,
but they're kind of triply related to each other. This is just Minkowski's flat space, so we're just redefining where its absolute position is in relative to where we put our coordinate system. So it's nothing really fun. I mean, we haven't really done anything to the mode. We just and what will end up happening is it's this dependence now on acceleration, which has units of 1 over the length, and the length of the mode, which will form our dimensionless parameter, that now will parameterize how much of the entanglement is degraded by this change in this parameter of A times the length. So this is a new parameter in the
model now that will give rise to some change in entanglement. And I guess
I want you to notice something, is that in this case, the tails here that penetrate the horizon at low accelerations are very, very small. They're almost non-existent. Whereas at larger and larger accelerations, more and more of the mode will pass through the horizon and therefore not be able to be reconstructed by any accelerated observer in the region 1. And this is essentially where all of the results that we're going to see come from. So Andre explained this, and I'll just quickly go through it again. We start with not a two-mode Fock state, which was typically done, but with a two-mode squeeze state between the two inertial parties, Alice and Bob, simply because it's a squeezing operator, and you would expect that calculations are going to be easier to do, given that the transformation between the Minkowski and the Rindler state is a squeezing operator. And that turns out to be the case. And we calculate the covariance matrix of both the detectors, Alice and Rob, who is accelerated and has this accelerated detector which makes projected measurements on the initial two-mode squeeze set, and then just calculate this measure of entanglement.
It's logarithmic negativity. I don't have time to explain exactly what it is, but for those of you who know it, it's just for those of you who don't know, it's just a measure of entanglement. Now, Andre gave some sort of physically motivated way of constructing a detector. He motivated by saying that it's the same for each accelerated observer. And the results, therefore, became due to this mismatch between what would happen for each accelerated observer as they're seeing this mode. But a natural thing you may wonder is, well, why choose that particular mode? You can do better, possibly, by having an A-dependent parameterization of your mode. And how much of the original entanglement can
accelerated observers see if they try to do the best they can. And there is an upper limit because, well, let me explain why. So we start with a mode which is positive frequency in Minkowski space. This is our inertial mode. From here on, just forget about Alice. Alice, we're going to assume she's inertial and she can perfectly measure her part of the two-mode squeeze state. So everything I'm talking about here, we can just imagine is just Bob. And this is just Bob's mode. And his mode has a decomposition in terms of these Grimler frequencies, omega 1, omega 2, and their negative frequencies, those two things. And he is completely localized in the region 1. So the region 2 parts, he has no access over. Furthermore, he can only construct a sensible detector out of the positive frequency subspace of Rindler plane waves, because if he tries to use the negative frequencies, he'll get contradictory results. One example of this would be that he would see particles in the vacuum, in the Rindler vacuum, which is not what we want this detector to do. And another reason, I think, is motivated by Juan's talk yesterday, in that as long as you stick to the positive frequencies, I believe that the mode doesn't suffer from problems with localization. It is localized to the amount that you possibly can do in a way that is allowed and doesn't cause signaling problems. So maybe intuitively the best thing that you could do would be to take this initial mode and just cross out this part, which is in region 2, this part, and this part. And so you're only left with this part left, and then renormalize it. And you would intuitively expect that that is possibly the best thing that this detector, this accelerated detector, can see, because all those other bits it doesn't have access to. And of course, you can prove that that is true. It's in three lines. So you just take any other detector, also satisfying this positive frequency condition. And you expand it out in terms of these Rindler frequencies, and then use this version of the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality here to expand out this sum. And then this is, because this mode psi prime is normalized, this is just one, so you get left with this bit here. But this bit, after a little bit of calculation, I don't have time actually to wait for you to do that, but just if you take the inequality of those two, you'll see it's just exactly this optimized overlap. So if this optimized overlap with the inertial mode is the best possible that you can do, in the sense that it maximizes the overlap, the magnitude of the overlap for any other detector that you can construct, as you would intuitively expect. And here are the results. So we don't we start with something like a Gaussian mode. It's positive frequency sort of subspace of this Gaussian mode, so which keeps it localized in the way that we want, so around some position 1 over a. And at low accelerations, the blue line shows you what the inertial Gaussian mode is that this detector is trying to see. And the red line, as you can see, it stops here, is the mode that the best possible detector would look like. And they more or less agree with each other. And as you get to larger accelerations, you see that more and more of the inertial mode, which penetrates this horizon at x equals 0, and therefore, the best possible detector can't compensate as well, and it looks a little bit different. And so there's a mismatch between, there's an inevitable mismatch. This is any detector could not do any better than this. And so this is what it looks like, this overlap. It decreases from 1 down as you increase the acceleration. And I'm showing here also how the mean number of particles, the Rindler particles, look to this detector. And they're, as you can see, very small at this level of acceleration times the length, and don't really play a strong role in this effect. And here's the final slide that I want to show, which is the actual the best possible entanglement that can be reconstructed by these detectors. And so in the thin line, you can see the results of the Gaussian detectors that Andre was talking about, the kind of physically motivated thing that you could do if you just try to accelerate a cavity and think about how you would reconstruct the detector in that way. And shown in these thick lines are these optimized detectors. So given an initial state, what the best possible thing any detector, any observer could see if he tried as hard by changing the mode shapes in every different way he could. He could never beat this limit. And so what you're seeing here is the different levels of the initial squeezing of the two mode squeeze state, S. You're seeing the best possible entanglement that can be achieved. And what you see is this interesting effect happening at about half of A times L. And what it is up until that point, effectively, you can reconstruct almost all of the entanglement that was originally present. And that's because none of the mode was really penetrating the horizon. It's just a very, very exponentially small part of the tail. But as you go to larger and larger A of L, the position of the inertial mode gets closer and closer to the horizon. And at about this level is when the tail of the Gaussian starts to become significant, and then you start getting this, of course, this loss of entanglement. So, how am I doing for time? I took out the slides. 3 minutes.
I have to blame Andre for that because I had more slides. But, what I might just also do then is just also spend a little bit of time talking about some work which is
a little bit, we're not 100% sure of this yet, but
I think it's right. Let me, if I explain it in the right way, then we can also calculate what happens in the really large acceleration limit, right? So if we go to larger and larger, maybe I can't do that if I've hidden the slide. Hang on. Don't skip slide. So if we go to really, really large accelerations,
now the reason I want to say this is it becomes less and less clear what the meaning of this situation is, because the detector becomes more and more squeezed towards the origin, and therefore it has a very, very great large variation in the acceleration over the width of the detector. So it's not clear to us exactly if this is a sensible thing or not. But as we go to larger and larger accelerations, what we see is this Wormianoid gets larger and larger until effectively it actually gets about the size of the overlap square. And so now we're getting into the Wormianoid-dominated part of the entanglement profile. And what we see is that these curves that originally I cut off somewhere around here, they don't flatten out to some kind of asymptotic flat profile, but they experience a sudden death. Approximately when, I can calculate exactly analytically where that happens. Approximately when this Unruh mean particle number is equal to the overlap. So this enters into an Unruh noise dominated regime, and the Unruh noise is just really bad noise into your detection of this entangled state, and it essentially kills off all the entanglement. So I can paraphrase this by saying this would be an ultimate limit on any detector as you go to these large accelerations, although we're not sure if these optimized detectors are reasonable, realistic in that sense, but it would still be an upper bound to any detector. So I'll stop there.